This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After creating the HBO series 6 Feet Under, about a family that runs a funeral home and is steeped in death, Alan Ball has created a new HBO series about the undead. True Blood, which premiered on Sunday, is about vampires who have returned from the grave and live on a newly developed synthetic blood called True Blood. Their presence is so new, no one knows what to make of these vampires. Some people find them sexy. Many people fear them. Some are just curious. The vampires have formed their own lobby group, which is pushing for a passage of a Vampire Rights Act. The series is based on Charlaine Harris's Southern Vampire series of novels. Alan Ball also directed and wrote the new movie Towelhead, which we'll talk about a little later. Ball won an Oscar for his screenplay, American Beauty. Let's start with a scene from the first episode of True Blood. Anna Paquin plays a waitress in a small Louisiana town. A handsome, mysterious stranger has just walked in, and she's ready to take his order.
Hi, what can I get for you tonight?
Do you have any of that synthetic bottled blood?
No, I'm so sorry. Sam got some a year ago, but nobody ever ordered it, so it went bad. You're our first.
Am I that obvious?
I knew the minute you came in. Can't believe nobody else around here seems to.
He does.
Oh, don't worry about Sam. He's cool. I know for a fact he supports a vampire rights amendment.
How progressive of him.
Well, anything else you drink?
Actually, no. But you can get me a glass of red wine so I have a reason to be here.
Well, whatever the reason, I'm glad you are.
Alan Ball, welcome back to Fresh Air. Let's start with some of the basic plot points for True Blood. Why have the vampires come out of their coffins and returned?
The vampires have made their presence known to humans because there's been a development of synthetic blood by a Japanese biotech firm for medical purposes, which the vampires claim satisfies all their nutritional requirements. And so there's no reason for humans to fear them. And they've put together a lobbying organization, and they're lobbying for equal rights. And ultimately, what is at the root of everything, which is not very clear at this point in the show, is they want ownership. They want to be able to own things. And whether or not vampires can actually survive on True Blood alone is also something we just sort of have to take their word for. Although in this world, there are plenty of people who are willing to let vampires feed on them.
Yeah, it's because it's kind of a kick for people. It's like, wow, they're vampires.
It's a kick. It usually is accompanied by sex. And apparently vampires are pretty good at sex.
Yeah, and where does that come from? Where does that part of the lore come from?
I wondered about that, and I think, certainly if you've been around 100 years, you have time to perfect your technique. But I also think, and part of the way we're playing vampires and the supernatural in general is that it's not something that exists outside of nature. It's actually a deeper, more primal manifestation of nature, so deep and primal sometimes that we as humans don't even have the perception to see it or feel it. So those are my own answers to the questions. In the books that the series is based on, the Southern Vampire series by Charlaine Harris, pretty much all the vampires seem to be excellent bedfellows.
You know, it's funny, in the original Bram Stoker Dracula novel, the novel seems to be so much about sexual fear, you know, sexual attraction and sexual fear. And it's mm-hmm. it's almost like a metaphor for sexually transmitted disease.
Mm. Well, I think it certainly took on that characteristic during the AIDS, once the AIDS epidemic hit. But it's also just a metaphor for sex. Someone is penetrated, bodily fluids are exchanged. There is a sort of surrender. So it's a pretty potent, no pun intended, metaphor, for just sex in and of itself, I think, and has been for ever since Bram Stoker's Dracula.
And in your series, True Blood, there's a big connection between sex and danger. And there's several characters in it who really like sex and danger combined.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it gets more dangerous than they expected. But why was that interesting for you two, exploring that connection that exists for some people?
I don't really know. I think it was just a visceral thing. I think when I started reading the books, they had a sort of pulpy sensibility. Everything was heightened, and each chapter ended with a cliffhanger, and there was there's a big body count. And danger lurks around every corner, as does romance, as does, finding someone you love or meeting your maker in, however you choose to interpret that. And there was such a fun thrill ride, adventure, science fiction, if you will, feeling to the books that I just sort of went with that. It felt really liberating to me after working so long on material that was basically just about the intricacies of humans relating to each other, to actually go into a world where just fantastic things happen. And it's just kind of fun and silly. And when I pitched it to HBO for the first time, I said, this is popcorn television. You know, this is a popcorn TV show.
What else did you tell them?
Well, they asked me, well, what is the show about? And I had no answer, but being, the Hollywood person that I have become in some ways, unfortunately, over the years, I just started talking and hoped that something would come out of my mouth that sounded vaguely coherent. I think I talked about the fears that we project onto any minority group that is misunderstood or feared, and then I said, at the heart of it, though, it is a show about the terrors of intimacy. And I heard myself say that, and I thought, well, that sounds pretty good. And actually, the more that I look at it, I can sort of see that it is, in a sense, about the terrors of intimacy, about breaking that wall that keeps you separate and safe from a sometimes savage and dangerous world, and letting another person in. Ultimately is a terrifying act.
Especially when you're just meeting the person and you don't really know who they are. And, in a metaphorical way, it's done in True Blood because the main female character is telepathic. She can read people's minds, but not the
right.
mind of the vampire that she's falling in love with.
And
right. so in this character, she's meeting this vampire and not really sure, like, is he good or evil or a combination of both, or can she trust
right.
him or not? And
but at the same time, she can relax and just be herself without putting up this guard that she has to work at.
Yes, she guards against other people because reading their minds
she doesn't want to hear other
really
people's
complicates
thoughts.
Things. Yes, they're usually
yeah.
not good thoughts.
And it's a really sort of seductive space for her to just relax like that.
My guest is Alan Ball, and his new series, True Blood, just premiered on HBO. And it's about vampires who come out of their graves because synthetic blood is now available, so they no longer have to feed on humans. Did you grow up with any vampire movies or books?
When I was a kid, Dark Shadows started airing, and me and some of the neighborhood kids would rush home from school so that we could be there when it started. And when that organ music came on or whatever the music was, it was kind of spooky and there were shots of waves crashing against rocks. We would hold our necks like we couldn't breathe while the music was on. And then once the music was over, we'd leave and go outside and play because the show itself was kind of boring to us. But that was I knew what vampires were, but I've never really I'm not what one would call a vampire aficionado. I don't really, I haven't read a lot of the popular vampire fiction. There are movies and television shows I've never even seen.
Have you seen the Bela Lugosi Dracula or?
Yes, of course I've seen that.
Nosferatu, yeah. The Klaus Kinski Nosferatu.
I have seen the Klaus Kinski Nosferatu.
In the Klaus Kinski Nosferatu, there's so much brooding about the curse of eternal life. People think they'd love to live eternally, but if you ask the Klaus Kinski Nosferatu, he would see it as a curse.
Yeah, I would imagine that there is a curse aspect to it, because if you live forever, then why is this day important? You know, you lose everything.
You know,
everything you have, you lose eventually, unless there are other vampires. And I don't know. I just feel like the finite nature of life is kind of what makes it important.
You had to think a lot about blood in making this, both how you wanted, like what kind of stage blood you wanted to use, what color
right.
it should be, what thickness right. it should be.
Right.
You had to think about how it should taste to people. So what kind of things did you do blood-wise to prepare for making True Blood?
Well, in the world of True Blood, there is human blood and there's vampire blood. Human blood is the blood that flows through all of our veins. It's the same color. It's the same thickness. It's the same viscosity. Vampire blood is a highly volatile organic substance that, when ingested by humans, can have aphrodisiac qualities. It can have increased strength, increased senses as a byproduct. It can also be hallucinogenic. It can be a doorway into other perceptions. And so we wanted to make that very different and very sort of really decadent. So we made it darker and thicker. It's almost like molasses, and it's a really dark brownish red. As far as what it tastes like, I never really even thought of that. We certainly have I just let the actors act, you know, how they seem to enjoy it when they start drinking it. And we have dialogue referring to how True Blood, the synthetic blood, is a poor substitute for refined vampire palates.
I'd love to hear what casting was like, how people showed up, especially like for the lead vampire role, the role that Steve Moyer plays. Like, how do people show up for the role? Were they wearing what they thought would be appropriate?
Yeah. A lot of people came in wearing all black. You know, I've learned now that I've done a season of the show, you know, you got to be careful when you give an actor fangs, because their tendency is to go mad immediately and start doing vampire acting. Which I really wanted to avoid. I didn't want to have any of those strange contact lenses that, like, come into, you know, that all of a sudden their eyes change when their fangs come out, or there's any sort of prosthesis change in their facial structure. I just wanted to give them fangs and let them act. It was a really hard role to cast. We saw a lot of men. There were people that I took to the network that the network was not crazy about. There were people the network wanted to see that I was not crazy about. And then Stephen, I saw off a video that a casting director in London had made, and I watched it in a little, tiny little postage stamp size video on my computer. And there was something so, for lack of a better word, real about him, and this sort of world-weary but tragic feeling that he brought to it, aside from being really, really handsome, which helps.
In a worn-out way.
Yeah, exactly. Like, he's been through
yeah.
through hell. And there's mm-hmm. actually a great line in one of the episodes where Sookie says, "How old are you?" And he said, "I was 30 human years when I was made vampire." And she goes, "Wow, you look older than that." And he says, "Well, life was harder then." But he really brought, for me, what he brings to the role is the sense of it's tragic. It's tragic what happened to him. He did not ask to be made vampire. He lost his family and his children. He lost his life. And now he's condemned to wandering the world at night, not being a part of the world that he was so much a part of before he was made vampire, before he went off to fight in the Civil War. So we brought Stephen over. And I worked with him for a day, and then we went into HBO, and it became very obvious very fast that this was the guy we'd been waiting for.
So did he not dress in all black for the audition?
You know, he wore jeans and like a blazer.
No chains or anything?
No, he didn't come in all black, and he didn't come in with, you know, the sort of extreme eyebrows and that kind of thing. And I like that about him, because I want Bill to, you know, just be a guy who is a vampire.
You said you wanted to just give your actors fangs and let them act. And so yeah. Talk about the fangs.
Well, in keeping with our idea about the supernatural being a deeper, more profound manifestation of nature, we really thought a lot about the physiology of the fangs. And we created fangs that actually lie flat along the roof of the mouth and then click into place when a vampire is in danger or aroused or ready to feed, much like a rattlesnake's fangs click into place. And we actually created a model of teeth with showing how the fangs click in and click out. And then we put the fangs not on the not with the forefront teeth between them, but with only two, because it worked better for the physiology of the rattlesnake, the snake fang working. And I like that because it looks a little different. It doesn't look like the classic thing. And I like the fact that it's not just like this supernatural teeth morph into fangs, you know. It's actually part of their physiology. And there's a sound they make when they click, which is kind of like a weapon being loaded. So it really worked. It helps, you know, it works well for the show in that regard, I think.
Did you have to work with a dentist in order to get them made?
Oh, yeah. Everybody. And even when we cast, you know, guest vampire for one episode, they have to go off and get impressions made of their teeth and they make fangs. And it's hilarious to watch the dailies because the actors will, like, make a face and then we'll stop and everybody will go get their little plastic cup with their fangs and put their fangs in. And, you know, make sure they're fit. And then the scene keeps going.
So can the actors activate the fangs by pressing a button in their mouth?
No. They have to. That has to be done with visual effects. The fangs are just the actual fangs that they place on their teeth once they've extended. But the extending and the retracting of fangs we have to do as a visual effect. And we have to put little dots on the actor's face as tracking marks.
I see.
So if you ever watch an unfinished cut of our show, there's some unintentional humor in those moments.
So we talked a little bit about casting Stephen Moyer as the lead vampire. Mm-hmm. Anna Paquin plays a waitress who is telepathic and starts to fall in love with the vampire and he with her, or at least that's the way it's looking. Talk about why you cast her. People will probably know her from The Piano.
And the X-Men movies.
And the X-Men movies, yeah. And The Piano, she was like, what are you?
11.
Yeah, she was really young.
Yeah. When I heard that Anna wanted to come in and read for Sookie, I was surprised. I thought, well, why does she want to do this? She's a movie star. But she aggressively pursued it. And then I thought about it and I thought, well, it makes perfect sense. It's a great role. It's the lead of the show. She's sexy and she's a romantic heroine and she's strong and she's, you know, she gets to play the gamut of human emotion and also have all these great chase scenes and fight sequences. And it actually makes perfect sense to me. And I wasn't too sold on the idea at first because Sookie is described in the books as being blonde and blue-eyed. And I had only known Anna with dark hair, which is her natural hair color. But, you know, once she came in and she started reading and I started working with her, what she was playing and what I really thought made the character really interesting was I could see that this is a woman who had been hearing other people's thoughts her entire life. And that she was kind of skittish and nervous and jumpy and a little angry. And it kept her from being, you know, a lot of girls came in and they were like sorority girls. You know, they overdid the Southern accent or they sort of came in dressed like Daisy May. And I was like, no. And the character just came alive in a way with Anna that was the most interesting. And so that's who we cast. Because I always feel like I don't, you know, I will have a clear idea of what I think a character looks like when I write it. But the minute I start going into casting, I let it go because you don't want to, you want to be open to people coming in and doing different interpretations because sometimes those interpretations are going to be better and they're going to work better and they're going to make the character live more.
Alan Ball will be back in the second half of the show to talk about his new movie, Towelhead. Ball's new HBO series, True Blood, premiered Sunday. One scene featured a vampire advocating vampire rights on Bill Maher's HBO show.
We're citizens. We pay taxes. We deserve basic civil rights just like everyone else.
Yeah, but, I mean, come on. Doesn't your race have a rather sordid history of exploiting and feeding off innocent people for centuries?
3 points. Number one, show me documentation. Doesn't exist. Number two, doesn't your race have a history of exploitation? We never owned slaves, Bill, or detonated nuclear weapons. And most importantly, point number three, now that the Japanese have perfected synthetic blood, which satisfies all of our nutritional needs, there is no reason for anyone to fear us.
Alan Ball, you have a new movie that's about to premiere called Towelhead. And it's a movie about a 13-year-old girl who is the daughter of a Lebanese-American father and a American mother, but the parents are separated. And the 13-year-old is now living with her mother and her mother's boyfriend. And the movie is really about her transition into being a sexual person and how confusing it is for her and for the people around her. Would you describe the opening scene?
The opening scene of Towelhead is very similar to the opening scene of Towelhead, the novel, in that Jasira is living with her mother and her mother's live-in boyfriend, Barry, who's a little bit younger than her mother, and is kind of a stoner and a nice guy. And Jasira has – girls have been making fun of her at school in swim class because her pubic hair can be seen around the edge of her bathing suit. So Barry offers to help her shave, and that's the opening scene of the movie. The mom finds out about this, flips out, understandably, and sends her daughter away to live with her father rather than kicking her boyfriend out.
And we should explain, when he shaves her, I mean, what we see is she's wearing her bathing suit and she has shaving cream around the periphery of the bathing suit. So
yes.
She could
shave off. And I've always actually thought that.
Hair. Yeah, go ahead.
I've always thought that Barry was not, in his mind, I think he's not a very bright person, and I think he probably smokes a lot of pot. I think he thinks he's doing her a favor. It's not like – I don't think he sexualizes her, but at the same time he knows to tell her it's probably best if you don't tell your mom about this.
So the mom decides to send her away, send Jasira away to live with her father. Mm-hmm. And I want to play a short scene. This is Maria Bello as the mother, and Jasira is played by Summer Bichelle. And they're both at the airport as the mother is saying goodbye and explaining why she has to send Jasira away. And Jasira is weeping.
Stop crying, okay? Shh, I know. Listen to me, okay? This whole thing is your fault. All right? The way that you walk around with your boobs stuck out, it's impossible for him not to notice. And you're always talking about your pubic hair.
Once. And only because the girls at the pool called me Chewbacca.
I don't know what that is.
Barry does.
Bottom line is, Jasira, there are right ways to act around men and wrong ways, and for you to learn which is which, you should go live with one.
I'm sorry. This is for your own good. I'm telling you, you're going to thank me for this later. Shh, people are looking at us, honey.
That's a scene from Alan Ball's new movie, Towelhead. And, boy, that's just about the worst thing that the mother could have said to the daughter there, to blame her for her own sexuality and for the effect that it has on men, and to take mm-hmm. The mother takes no responsibility for what's happening in her own home.
Well, it's too threatening. It's too competitive. She's hyper aware of you know, the fact that she's getting older, her daughter is attractive, her boyfriend's looking at it, and she's so terrified of being alone that the only way she can deal with it is to get rid of her daughter. Something she does grow to regret.
The novel's written by a woman.
Right. So
tell me what you related to about the story.
I think what I related to in the story was how much I was able to understand Jasira and what she was feeling and her desire to feel some pleasure or some sense of power and adventure in what was basically a very sterile and arid life in which Everybody seemed to want to control her. Everybody seemed to want to keep her from doing anything. Everybody seemed to want to just deny her her very existence and for her to do the same thing. Except for the men who want to take advantage of her. But even they don't really see her. They see an idea that fits into their own particular pathology. But they don't really see that, that there is an actual person there. So I guess what I related to, it felt so real. It felt so vivid and so true. And I loved the messiness of the feelings. And I loved the fact that the story refused to judge any of the characters, even though some of the characters do reprehensible things. The story refused to not see them as human beings. And I certainly responded to that. I guess, you know, going back to my own youth, my own becoming aware of my own sexuality when I was 13, because I'm gay, there was a lot of shame and confusion and secrecy. And it's like, I'm not supposed to be feeling these things. I shouldn't be feeling these things. And so I guess there's a little bit of transference that I could get into her head and identify with her a little bit. But mostly it was just the sheer power of the writing and the power of the story and the fact that she goes on this harrowing journey, that she is somewhat provocative. She's curious. And once again, the story refuses to condemn her for that. And ultimately, she sort of transcends a horrible event in a way that makes you feel like she is really in control of her own body and her own identity and her own life for the first time. And that, to me, felt very refreshing because I feel like the conventional wisdom model that we have built so that we can wrap our brains around such a horrible event as child sexual assault is that the child is 100% innocent victim, is ruined for life, doesn't do nothing to provoke it, does not enjoy it in any way, is not curious, and the adult instigator is subhuman, evil, predator who has no soul, and it's the worst thing that a human being can be. I just feel like that denies both – that really keeps us from seeing a lot of what actually allows these events to happen. I don't know. I just felt it was so refreshing to see a young girl character especially experience something like this and not be destroyed by it. In fact, I feel like she was probably a little stronger because of it.
I guess I feel I should acknowledge here that for some people, they really are victims. And in their instances, a lot of them, where the guy really has behaved like a monster. The adult
Absolutely.
Really has behaved
like a monster.
Absolutely.
I'm not denying that at all. I just think that anytime we try to simplify something into one paradigm, that what it does is it denies us from seeing a lot of the complexity and considering that this is such an incredibly common experience. I do think there is somewhat of a knee-jerk need in our culture to sort of fetishize victimhood and make it something in and of itself, which is not always good. That's just what I'm saying. But that's not to say that people who do this are not doing something monstrous.
This might be too personal, so just we'll just move on if it is. But I'll ask it, and then you could tell me if you want to answer. Mm-hmm. When you were young, when you were say Jazeera's age, 13, mm-hmm. did you have an encounter with an adult man that was a very ambiguous encounter for you?
I did. Not when I was 13. I was younger. I don't remember exactly how old I was. I did.
And I don't know what you're comfortable talking about in terms of that event and how it affected you as a person and as an artist.
Well, I'm sure it affected me in a lot of ways. I'm sure it affected my feelings about sexuality, my body, whatever. I don't see myself as a victim. And I don't I'm not particularly interested in identifying with victimhood. That's why I don't even really think that I was molested. It was someone who was older, but he was not, you know, that much older. It wasn't like he was a grown adult man. I don't know. I've certainly never talked about it, and it's not because I'm ashamed of it. It's just that it's like, well, that happened. You know, I feel like other things happened to me in my life that were way more traumatic and way more damaging, that I have had to struggle with to sort of get past the trauma for years and years and years. But I know a lot of people go like, what's with this guy? Why does he keep writing about old guys lusting after young girls? What a pervert. What a creep. And the reason I write about these things is because it has personal resonance for me.
Have you tried to like figure out what was going on in this guy's mind when you were young and he had that encounter with you?
I think, no, I haven't.
I asked because you tried to get into, say, the Kevin Spacey character's mind in
American
Beauty.
Well, I
think
he was, I think growing up as we did in, you know, in the South, in the, was this like the mid-60s probably, I think he was probably aware of homosexual feelings on his part. And probably aware of a certain energy within me. And because we didn't live in a culture where there were really any sort of legitimized ways of exploring that, because at that point, you know, one didn't even talk about being gay or consider it as just another expression of human sexuality. I think probably because we were both so shamed by just the cultural take on who and what we were that it, you know, it just sort of happened.
You know, in your
my memories are very sketchy, and I don't want to, you know, I really, I mean, I'm fine to talk about this, but I don't want to be one of those people who's like, I was molested.
Well, do you think of the word molested, or do you think that's the wrong word for what you experienced?
No, I'm just talking about people who go on TV or go, you know, get interviewed by magazines, and it's all about, I'm sharing this deep, painful secret. Because I sort of feel like, you know what? You want some painful secrets? I got much more painful secrets than that one.
You know, I'm curious. Like in Telhead, the Jazeera character, the 13-year-old, has somebody who enters her life who is a sane adult. Like maybe for the first time, there's a real, like, sexually sane adult in her life.
Yes.
Was there someone like that in your life who you could turn to when you were confused about your own sexual identity?
You know what? I think my sister would have served that role. I think my sister knew that there was something different about me. I remember she gave me a poster for my birthday once. It was that Thoreau quote about if a man marches to the beat of a different drummer. I think one of her close friends in high school was a guy who was gay. I think she would have been that person, but she died.
She died in a car accident, right?
Yeah, when I was 13. And then everybody in the family went insane after that. So I was really sort of on my own.
Right.
In a lot of ways, like Jasira was, now that you mention it, I can sort of see that sort of like left alone in the house, you know, that sort of solitary existence where the adults are all off, you know, in my case, dealing with their own breakdowns and that kind of thing. But I certainly related to that as well.
Do you think a lot of adults underestimate the sexual feelings of children and teenagers?
Yes. I think, you know, actually one thing that was really interesting when I sent the script out, a lot of people passed on it. A lot of people who ran, you know, studios. And literally I heard comments like, I can't possibly make this movie. I have daughters. And I thought, and that's exactly why you should make this movie. Yeah, I think people don't want to think that kids are sexually curious. But I think if we all just think back to our own childhood, of course we are. And especially in a culture now where everything is saturated with sex. You know, just watching, you know, mainstream TV or going to the movies or turning on your computer and looking at the images that are on your welcome page, it's just sex, sex, sex. And so I think it's much more in the faces of children now than it was when I was a kid. And I was fascinated by it. I think kids are naturally curious about sex, and there's nothing wrong with that. They just need somebody to, like, be straight with them.
During one of our interviews on Fresh Air about 6 Feet Under, you talked about how you really found it very difficult to go to funerals, and you'd often try to find like an excuse not to go, and
right.
In part because, you know, your sister died when you were 13, and it was such a traumatic experience for you and your family that it was
right.
just very difficult to deal with funerals. And then, of course, you made 6 Feet Under, which is about a family that runs a funeral home. And as
right.
we talked about, your new series, True Blood, is about, you know, vampires, the undead, who have slept in coffins, and there's graveyards in it and so on. Now, I read that after 6 Feet Under was completed, your mother died.
Yes.
Did you have to prepare her funeral?
Yes.
Did she?
I mean, my brother did the bulk of the work because he was there at the time, and he had sort of assumed the role as primary caretaker. But I was definitely there for that, and I definitely went to the funeral, and I definitely was there in the meetings with the people at the funeral home. And it was very funny because my mom had left very specific wishes. She wanted the cheapest casket. She didn't want any obituaries. She wanted a funeral with only her immediate family. She was like, don't do anything fussy. Those were her wishes. So I felt like we had no choice. We had to honor them.
Do you know why she wanted that?
I think part of it is just because she was always a person who really did not like people making a fuss over her or taking care of her. She was fiercely, fiercely independent. She was a child of the Depression, so she was really aware of money. She didn't want any money. She didn't want to spend any money on something like a funeral. But while we were there at the funeral home, the young guy who worked there came up to me and said, I just want you to know I'm in this business because of you. And I was really touched by that.
Uh-huh.
I thought, at first I said, well, that's a good thing, right? You like this business. He said, oh, yeah, I love it. I can't, you know, I'm so glad I found it. And then I was really touched by it. And it was, you know, it was hard. Seeing your parent dead is hard. You know, and she was in this cheap casket, and I wanted to look at her. We wanted to see her one last time. And so we looked at her, and I kissed her, you know, and that's something I never could have imagined myself doing.
Did she look like herself?
Not at all. No, she looked like something else. She refused to be embalmed. She did not want that, and she did not have anything, you know, any sort of cosmetic, anything done. But just the way she was laying, gravity did something different to her face. So it really looked like somebody different. And, you know, with her spirit gone, it wasn't her.
I sometimes really miss the characters from 6 Feet Under. Do you think about them much?
I don't. I feel like, you know, they when 6 Feet Under ended, it felt to me as if it was very – It was the right time, and it was time to let them go. And I think in shooting that last episode, we all sort of grieved for them. So I've kind of let them go, and I've said goodbye to them. But I love that they stay in your mind. That means that they were powerful on some level.
Yeah. Well, Ellen Ball, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. I really love talking to you. Let's do it again.
Ellen Ball's new movie, Towelhead, opens Friday. The new band called I'm Not Jim is essentially a collaboration between the novelist Jonathan Lethem and musician Walter Salles Humara, the leader of the indie band The Silos. Ken Tucker has a review of their CD, You Are All My People.
My tired dreaming head called her back to my bed. It's not enough to say there are no spaces in between. I'm tired. It's easy to say things are not as simple as they seem.
There's a tradition of novelists who've written rock songs. Rick Moody, Madison Smart Bell, the science fiction writer John Shirley, who wrote Blue Oyster Cult lyrics, Bob Dylan, I'm sure you reread Tarantula every summer, don't you? And let's see, Thomas Pynchon has written a lot of lyrics in his books that could be set to music. I'm sure you'll tell me who I'm forgetting. But to this select company, we must now add Jonathan Lethem, author of such excellent novels as Fortress of Solitude, Motherless Brooklyn, and my favorite, As She Climbed Across the Table. Lethem is a fan of The Silos, and upon meeting that band's Walter Salles Humara, found himself writing lyrics for what became the band I'm Not Jim, a quartet completed by the production team of Chris Maxwell and Phil Hernandez. The result is a series of real rock songs, not self-conscious literary set pieces.
Some days nothing.
That's Elevated Plane, and I don't know what it's about, and I don't really care. It's a good song. Walter Salles Humara sings the lyrics. He sings all the lyrics, by the way. As best I can tell, you don't hear Jonathan Lethem vocalizing at all here, nor does he play any instruments. Salles Humara sings the lyrics of Elevated Plane with a bluesy smear that suits the flat slam of the melody. This song and a few others, such as After Mild Winter, a fine composition about the general malaise that sets in after a breakup, have a gleaming, hard edge. Elsewhere, however, this group, I'm Not Jim, creates crisp little pop tunes with choruses that sound like forgotten hits from decades-old rock radio stations. One of my favorites, Amanda Morning, is a song I can imagine Paul Revere and the Raiders or the 1910 Fruit Gum Company releasing in 1969, which I mean is a high compliment.
In her bedroom in the dawn hours, under the covers, watch the clock, watch the second hand, watch the sand run out, get on a radar and claim a spot, pick the phone up, the man is on call waiting, stealing time.
There's a theme running through this album, You Are All My People. It's that few of the right people love the narrators of these songs. Breakups, unrequited love, loneliness, and self-reproach prevail. Lethem knows that the medium he's working in succeeds best when the sounds, not even words or turns of phrase, but the noise the words make, complement the melodies. Then there are amusing story songs organized around titles such as Drink Till I'm Sober, and this collection of similes called Meter Running in a Crashed Cab.
Like a meter running in a crashed cab, like a needle bumping round on in a groove, like a meter running in a crashed cab. The game's long over, but the players don't move. You're on my nerves, getting under my skin. I know sooner or later it's gonna sink in. The game got called on a count of doom. Singing operettas to an empty room like a...
It's easy to understand why Lethem admires Walter Salles Humara and the Silos, with their conversational voices and first-person miserable songs such as All She Wrote and The Only Story I Can Tell. Lethem's most recent novel, You Don't Love Me Yet, was about how hard it is to claim authorship of a rock song when its creation involves so much inner thought, followed by collaboration and accidents in the recording studio. Performing under the name I'm Not Jim, Lethem isn't Jonathan Lethem. He's just another guy in a band, teamed up with Salas Humara, who'll play Lennon to his McCartney, Jagger to his Richards, Davy Jones to his Mike Nesmith. More fun than a barrel of monkeys.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed the debut CD by I'm Not Jim.